I'm Christopher Lydon with the contemporary master poet C.K. Williams, retuning our ears to get the immortal Walt Whitman, the music, the vision, the prophetic new world identity, fresh and urgent on every reading. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is precisely about the poet's poet, in an occasional series we call Whose Words These Are. C.K. Williams at Princeton is an American poet decorated with both the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award, alongside a new book this year of his own, vivid and varied poems titled Wait. C.K. Williams has just published a luminous, I should say rapturous, account of a lifetime reading Whitman. C.K. Williams, there's a terrific urgency about your book, as if you'd discovered something almost brand new. I'm dying to hear some of these lines sounding fresh in your own voice.
Well, I'd love to read some, and I'm glad that it sounds as though he's just arrived, because that's one of the greatnesses of Whitman, is the sense that he has always just arrived in your consciousness. He's absolutely remarkable that way. And he is, as I say in the book, in some ways, he really is like the subconscious of modern American poetry. He is the ground from which we all rise. I'll read a few lines from the beginning of the poem. The atmosphere is not a perfume. It has no taste of the distillation. It is odorless. It is for my mouth forever. I am in love with it. I will go to the bank by the wood and become undisguised and naked. I am mad for it to be in contact with me. Then a little farther, the smoke of my own breath echoes, ripples, and buzzed whispers, love root, silk thread, crotch, and vine, my respiration and inspiration, the beating of my heart, the passing of blood and the air through my lungs. What's remarkable about him is this music that he found to write in, and music that he found to think in, to feel in, to imagine in. And for many people, most importantly, to create a person. He creates a character in the poems called Walt Whitman, who's a character not like the real Walt Whitman, though not terribly far off. He speaks a lot of the greatest poet, that he's going to define what the greatest poet is and what the greatest poet will do. And he says he is a seer, he is individual, he has completed himself. The others are as good as he, only he sees it and they do not. And that, in a way, was really what his task was, that he was seeing the world in this exalted, accepting, inclusive way. And through the music of the poetry, he was teaching us to see that way. And I think that's why he can remain so new every time you come back to him. It's as though you yourself are being invented again.
He writes about the greatest poet. He also writes about the perfect human being. He's creating a kind of almost Christ-like deity on American soil. What is that all about?
Well, at one point he actually does speak of himself as likens himself to a Christ. There was an early stage of his meditations and his thinking when he actually was thinking of calling this the New Bible, calling the Leaves of Grass, and fortunately he dropped that. But he was quite consciously trying to make a character, make a person who was an example to live by, the way Christ was an example to live by. But in some ways, the character he makes, who's a character who encloses religion, he encompasses religion, and he says it quite consciously and quite overtly, I am including religions. I am large enough even to include the great religious leaders.
It's almost more Protean than that, in the sense of he's going to be the decathlon champion. He's going to be the strongest man in the world. You quote him from an 1861 edition of Leaves of Grass saying that he wants to suggest the substance and form of a large, sane, perfect human being or character for an American man and for woman. It's going to be a great person, entirely modern, at least as great as anything in the Homeric or Shakespearean characters, a person with the free courage of Achilles, the craft of Ulysses, the attributes of the Greek deities, majesty, passion, temper, amativeness, Romeo, Lear, Antony, immense self-esteem, but after democratic forms, measureless love, the old eternal elements of first-class humanity. This was, as you say, a sort of construction, but did he mean it?
In the poem, he means it. In his life, he wasn't like that. The character who comes across as you were reading is someone who's very arrogant, charged with a ridiculous hubris. In his life, he wasn't like that. He was quite aware of the greatness of what he had created. But he was properly humble about it, properly realizing that as a poet it had been given to him the way it is given to poets. Mm-hmm. There's a great balance in poetry between will and submission. Okay, you have to submit to part of yourself that you usually don't consider. It's a part of consciousness that has music in it, for one thing. And there's an aspect of it of willing. And he's a remarkable balance of the willed and the submissive. He forces all this. When you read his notebooks, they're filled with rather banal observations and banal self-teachings and self-learnings. And then all of a sudden there is this music that arrives, which, as I say in the book, we really don't know how he got to it. And I think he doesn't really know how he got to it. Mm-hmm. It was one of his greatnesses for him to have realized that he got it. He grabbed it and he stayed with it. And it was just remarkable.
Exactly what do you mean, C.K. Williams, by the music here? You make it sound almost as if he's singing these poems.
He is singing. It's a kind of singing. The music of language, the way poets control language and measure and make language move is closest to music, and it probably comes from one of the modules in the brain that's different from the language module, so that the fusion of the music and language in poetry is, for those that hear it, that's what makes it so addictive and so glorious.
I love the idea of the music of Walt Whitman, especially because, never having seen Walt Whitman, I have seen Sonny Rollins on stage, and Sonny Rollins seems to me to embody Walt Whitman. I mean, for one thing, he's an incredible improviser, but all American sound, in a way, is his material. I mean, he will do variations from one bar to another on TV jingles, movie music, cowboy songs, jazz standards, opera. Pretty much anything is fair game in Sonny's sort of assembling these sounds and then taking them to a level of great excitement and expressive energy. It helps me understand Sonny Rollins to think of him as Whitman and vice versa.
That's a very interesting thought. It's something that had never occurred to me. I tend to separate actual music, what we call traditionally music, from the music of poetry. I mean, Whitman finds America in a different way. It's interesting. He has the colloquial spoken voice of the America at the time he lived, which is pretty close to the one we have. If you compare him to someone like Longfellow, who was by far the more successful poet in their lifetimes, Longfellow is writing in a very classical European tradition, with which Whitman actually had some contempt for. And Whitman is speaking in a language that was and still is American, although not – we've actually – obviously language changes all the time. Its rhythms subtly change. But his music, his language music is still very accessible to us.
I'd love you to linger with that one, tear and compare Longfellow. Longfellow's house, big, yellow mansion on Brattle Street is still there. And, of course, people still recite The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere and some people The Song of Hiawatha. Tell the story of how Whitman came to eclipse him almost entirely.
I don't really know. I mean, it's really not explicable how it happened. I mean, there's no question it did happen. There's no question what he started. Hiawatha was published in the same year as Leaves of Grass, and Hiawatha sold, I think, 50,000 copies. And Whitman, if he sold 100, really, it was lucky. He gave away most of the book. Of course, he published the book himself. Hiawatha, Whitman's mother, said, "I don't see much difference between it and your poem," which was really quite an insult to poor Whitman, who adored his mother. But Hiawatha quickly faded away. It was an early Victorian poem. It was the end of a tradition. And at the time, Hemingway once pointed out that when decadence arrived, it's often the fullest flowering of a style or a form. And afterwards it falls off. And you could say that in some ways Hiawatha was the fullest flowering of one tradition of American poetry, the narrative metrical tradition. And he did it brilliantly. And then, boom, that tradition really died and his poetry pretty much died with him. I actually went back to read him because when I was a kid, he was the first poet my father read to me. The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere and Hiawatha and Children's Hour, Between the Dawn and the Daylight. Mm. The day, I can still recite it. I went back to it and it's awful. It's just dead. And that happens quite a bit with poets. An interesting thing can happen is that sometimes poets are reborn and come back and suddenly there's something in them that is vital again that we find. I don't see any sign of that yet with Longfellow, but who knows?
Hmm. Those forms in Longfellow are dead because Walt Whitman introduced an entirely new language and line and rhythm and then subject matter. That, I suppose, is what we really have to explain this hour, is just what he did, maybe starting with just inventing himself as a poet, reinventing the idea of who a poet is.
I think there's an element of that. He was, in a sense, the first truly democratic poet. Mm. That is, his material was the demos, the people, what he saw around him, who he interacted with. But it is the way he sees the world. He brings the world in the world of carriage drivers, of people making love, of politicians, of prophets. He brings everybody into the vision that he has. Mm. And that's absolutely remarkable and groundbreaking. In the book, I speak about Baudelaire who in France who had a similar kind of revolution but it worked out much differently in that he began to see that beauty, the notion of beauty that up till then we had was a limiting notion. And he found beauty in what was not usually considered beautiful, an exquisite form of verse. Mm-hmm. Whitman similarly found the world we lived in and live in still to be the possible subject for poetry and the possible inspiration. He's driven by what's actually there in a way that poets hadn't been.
Your pairing him with Baudelaire is fascinating. I mean, it's so commonplace to see Whitman and Emily Dickinson as kind of the pair that all else descends from. But you rather neatly break up that couple.
Yes. I'm a huge admirer of Dickinson. I think she was a great, great poet. And I said this at a conference a month or so ago and got great boos from the feminists in the audience. But she wasn't the influence that Whitman was. She's too sui generis. She's too much herself. And you read her with awe, but you read her also with the sense of, I could never be like that. I could never think like that. She was absolutely brilliant, intellectually brilliant. But you can think, I am Whitman. I will be like Whitman. I can see the world as Whitman does. Hers is very, very, a very precious thing in America to have Dickinson. But she wasn't the influence that he was, and she wasn't the influence that Baudelaire was. Baudelaire, both Whitman and Baudelaire were influences all over the world, not just in America. As I speak in the book, Whitman had a terrific influence on poetry everywhere it hit, from Russia to Turkey to Latin America. Similarly, Baudelaire did. I think Whitman finally had a greater influence. But Dickinson is herself. She's ours. She doesn't translate so well either. I know her French translator, and the French love her, but they don't really realize how much greater she is than she can be in another language. Whitman is interesting that way too. It's something that it just occurs to me. He's very translatable because of his unprogrammatic music. People can translate him into their own language and keep the surge and keep the cadences. And you hear, for instance, in Lorca, especially in Poet in New York, when he actually writes about Whitman, you can hear the surge. And there was a poet, Adonis, who's the great Lebanese-Syrian poet, who I read with him at Columbia a few years ago. He read some of his poems and I read translations. And there's a poem that's also dedicated to Whitman and really sounds like Whitman. And Whitman is translatable. That's something I should have put in the book.
Going back to Emily Dickinson for a moment, you'd have to say that Whitman has a huge feminist following, maybe best expressed by Alicia Ostreicher in your book, out of an essay about loving Walt Whitman. She says very powerfully that Whitman enacts the crossing of gender categories in his own person. It is not his claim to be of the woman, however, that speeds us on our way, but his capacity to be shamelessly receptive as well as active, to be expansive on an epic scale without a shred of nostalgia for narratives of conquest, to invent a rhetoric of power without authority, without hierarchy, and without violence.
That's a brilliant statement, isn't it?
It's gorgeous, and it's a big endorsement.
There's, of course, a lot been written about Whitman's homosexuality and a lot of responses to it. But it's wonderful the way hers transcends that. It doesn't say that because he was a homosexual, he understood women better. There's nothing like that in what she says. She sees this person that he creates in the poems as encompassing genders. It's a wonderful notion.
He says about Leaves of Grass that sex is the root of it all. Just what did he mean by that manifesto?
I'm not quite sure. Maybe he was just a precursor of Freud. Perhaps. And the poem starts off with this strange passage in which he's making love to himself. I don't quite know. I mean, he certainly regards sexuality as a source of energy. There's no question. There's a lot of that in the book. At one point he says, sex contains all, bodies, souls, meanings, proofs, purities, delicacies, results, promulgations, songs, commands, health, pride, the maternal mystery, the seminal milk, all hopes, benefactions, bestowals, all the passions, loves, beauties, delights of the earth, all the governments, judges, gods, followed persons of the earth, these are contained in sex as parts of itself and justifications of self.
Hmm. Would you read that little passage about the hairy wild bee? I mean, that's sex in another dimension, perhaps, but it's so brilliant.
It's from a poem called Spontaneous Me, which really is a song of sex. The hairy wild bee that murmurs and hankers up and down, that grips the full-grown lady flower, curves upon her with amorous firm legs, takes his will of her, and holds himself tremulous and tight until he is satisfied.
You also quote something I've never seen before from Gerard Manley Hopkins, a priest and a Catholic above all, but saying, I always knew in my heart Walt Whitman's mind to be more like my own than any other man's living.
But he says, but Whitman was a scoundrel. He doesn't like to say that.
Well, a lot of people could say that with great devotion to Walt Whitman, I think.
It's always been a source of mystery why he said that. What? Because he's considered he was a secret homosexual or a repressed homosexual. And people have said that's what he meant because he saw the homosexuality. I play with the idea in the book that perhaps it was masturbation, in fact, because a celibate priest would at some point have had to face the challenge of masturbation. And Whitman doesn't consider it a challenge. He considers it a delight. I mean, it quite frankly has masturbation passages in it that are quite wonderful. And my guess
about
is that
my love grip and all that.
Oh yeah, and it may have been that that's what Hopkins was really speaking about, though he never explained anymore. I think he also recognized, aside from that, he was innovating in poetry too. He was taking poetry in a direction it really hadn't gone before, with his metrical experiments, which were quite astonishing. And I think that's what he really saw more than anything else in Whitman. He saw another person who was a revolutionary, an innovator, and possibly a greater innovator than he was. Although he wasn't, I don't think, competitive with Whitman in that sense.
Mr. Williams, speak of some of the other ways that he is so modern. The first Freudian poet in a certain way, but also, you write, the first poet of evolutionary time who can see sort of geological time as we speak about it now.
Yes, it's really remarkable that he was that current with what was happening in science, what had happened with Wallace and with Darwin and with the general reimagining of the time on Earth, which was very new. And there's a passage, eternity lies in bottomless reservoirs. Its buckets are rising forever and ever. They pour and they pour and they exhale away. We have thus far exhausted trillions of winters and summers. There are trillions ahead and trillions ahead of them. Births have brought us richness and variety, and other births will bring us richness and variety. I do not call one greater and one smaller. That which fills its period and place is equal to any other. That's a really wonderful moralizing of evolution.
Yeah, it sounds like Carl Sagan on the Johnny Carson show talking about billions and billions of stars.
Yeah, maybe he had read Whitman.
I think. There's another little detail here about Walt Whitman in the electronic age, in the digital age, the democratic information media of our time, blogging specifically. It seems to me his devout democratic sense of everybody out there making America is caught in this little fragment from a poet named Carl Dennis. Just as blogging seemed to take over media maybe 10, 15 years ago, I came across this line from Carl Dennis about Walt Whitman. It seemed to me Walt Whitman is sort of the saint of blogging. But here's Carl Dennis's line. He says, Walt Whitman's idea of America is a country held together not by law or custom, but by a network of imaginative filaments thrown out by autonomous individuals who want to include as many people as they can in their own acts of self-definition. Strikes me that's exactly what bloggers do. They're tossing
that's
out
very
their lines.
Interesting. That's a brilliant statement by Carl Dennis, who's a wonderful poet. And that, but that's a really, really insightful way to see one of Whitman's not quite stated purposes. He states it actually in a more refined way than Whitman did, but I think it's a very deep vision of what Whitman was doing.
But I wondered, was Walt Whitman so deeply democratic that he really thought everybody could be out there doing what he was doing, kind of in their own acts of self-definition, so to speak?
I don't know. It's like saying, did Christ think that everybody could be Christ? I don't know that he thought that. I thought he probably thought of himself as an example, and I think possibly Whitman would think of himself as an example rather than someone who could be emulated in detail.
But there's that other piece of Whitman you write about in a little section called The Dare, or A Dare, in which Whitman invites the reader to be part of the poem. And you write that the reader with Whitman is a kind of apprentice to the poet.
I guess I mean that he's a kind of apprentice, not in the sense of a poet apprentice, as an apprentice to a master, but as a personal, spiritual apprentice, that Whitman can show the way to a more accepting kind of spirit, more accepting and more ecstatic. I mean, we can't leave that out. The poem is really an ecstatic poem. And ecstasy is not something that most of us have the experience of, or at least not very often. It's inspiring to read a poem in which there's ecstatic moment after ecstatic moment in which the world flares up with sudden illumination and small things, large things, time itself. And I think that's what we will eternally be apprentice to Whitman for.
You write a wonderful passage about the many Whitmans that speak to you, that sort of challenge you for supremacy. I'd love you to give us that.
Well, I'll read a passage that's directed toward that. How much of my admiration for the poems has to do with their aesthetic uniqueness and grandeur, and how much with the promise they make of a new kind of consciousness, indeed a new genre of identity. As a poet, I read with boundless admiration. As a person, I don't quite know what to think. How not wish to live in a state of unrestrained acceptance the way the speaker in The Leaves does? And that is true. I mean, you read it with – which Whitman am I with when I'm reading? And I mean, then there are these moments in which you realize there's only one Whitman, the Whitman who sings and the Whitman who sees and the Whitman who feels and the Whitman who promises. He promises so much. Every line in the poem, it's interesting, even the lines of personal despair are always directed to a you, to a listener, to the reader, in a way that really no other poet is quite. If you think of Eliot, for instance, for whom Whitman or Pound, often they're speaking sort of interiorly to themselves, and they're using the old lyric tradition of a poet thinking and being overheard, or a poet experiencing and being shared with. With Whitman, it's always directed. The voice is always going out to us in a way that really no other poet quite did it.
That's marvelous. And there are so many other categories that you write about in the same passage. You say you're in awe of the way he possesses his body, but without avarice, without greed. You're in awe of his prophetic identity. You're in awe of that sense he gives of being beyond poetry. And then you say, now it's more simply that he defines some ultimate reach that poetry can have into life. I mean, it never ends.
I will admit that when I first started working on this book, the first draft of it, the first stab at it, let's say, because I started about 4 years before it was finally published and stopped for 3 years because I felt he was overwhelming me. He was just annihilating every other notion of poetry I had. I spent a summer just reading everything about him, and there are some wonderful books about him that I speak of in the introduction, and then reading the poems again and again. And finally I thought, this guy is killing me. I have to stop. I'll never write another poem myself. And then when I finished my new book, I went back to it. And the book came very easily because I had sort of put him in his proper place in my own life and identity as a poet.
I was wrong. Your litany does end after a while. You say it remains his identity as a poet that convinces, not because of his sensitivities, his goodness, his proclamations, his unquestionable spiritual largeness, but almost entirely because of the music and the vision the music brings forth.
Yeah, that's true. And then we're back to being a poet and reading him. We've been speaking of him often as a kind of prophet, but in fact he was a poet. And that's the way poets work, is through the language music that they find for themselves and that they embody themselves in. And all the rest comes to that. Without that, you don't have anything. There was a critic who wrote and said something about that for Williams, the didactic trumps the aesthetic. And I was really quite put out by that because I say probably 10 times in the book that it's the music that does it. It's the music that does it. And it really is. Without that, we wouldn't hear him. When you read some of the things in the early notebooks that are often the same thing as he ends up saying, they're just matter. They're just information. They're just perceptions until he starts his amazing song.
Mr. Williams, could I take you back to something you said at the beginning, that Walt Whitman is in some fashion the subconscious of American poetry. I'd love you to explain just what you mean, but then I want to ask, why isn't he more nearly the subconscious of American life, especially political life? Whatever happened to those democratic vistas?
Well, I don't think they were ever there, unfortunately. I mean, he lived through a very tempestuous political time himself with several wars. The first war he was rather reprehensibly in favor of, the Mexican War. And then when the Civil War came, he went through all the turbulence and machinations that went on in the 1850s and really was in favor of the Civil War also as a way to save the Union, because the Union for him was America and his commitment to America was boundless and irreproachable. Then when the war actually happened after the war, he wrote the series of poems called Drum Taps, in which he confronts the fact that war, for whatever, quote, good reason, is a horror. And the rest of his life, he lived again in a period when he saw the beginnings of the Gilded Age, when the rich were taking over America the way some people say they are now or have now. So the vision of America that he has is a kind of positive unconscious vision. I think that's the only way to see it. It never happened, just as the Freudian libido never happens, really. It's there. It's a source of energy. And for Whitman, the vision of this democratic, unified consciousness that America could be is there no matter what. Now, is it there in the minds of some of our more malignant politicians and commentators? Probably not. Is it there in the vision that Americans have of themselves that often can seem so self-destructive and perverse? Probably yes. Probably he did help to make this idea, this notion of America as special. He's very clear in saying America is special. Toward the end of his life, he began to feel as though it wasn't so special because of all the corruption that was swirling around him. But there would be no question that it's part of what makes America think it's special. And in some ways, America, for good and ill, often unfortunately for ill, is special.
Of course, he never realized his vision of America, and I'm sure he knew it never could be exactly real. But he did give – he still gives people a sense of what we're supposed to be about. I mean, his America was a nation of workers, hard workers, black workers, women workers. It was – an absolutely democratic and very substantially egalitarian bunch of strivers who were making it every day. I guess I don't even think that is our subconscious notion of what we're supposed to be, why we're here anymore. And I wonder where that went.
This is something a poet is not qualified to respond to. I don't even know if a citizen is qualified to respond to. That's such a huge question. It surmounts poetry. It surmounts everything. It's human history. We always evolve ideals. We evolve moralities. And then as soon as we can, we betray them. And America has done its share of betrayals, certainly, and continues to.
I'm just reminded that we had a conversation years ago, 5 years ago, with Studs Terkel, for whom Walt Whitman's America is the only real one, the only one worth fighting and dying for. And
Studs Terkel said that?
He did. He said it eloquently, and maybe we should hear him again.
We can learn from Whitman today, every human being is important, that the Iraqi war is obscene. Our appreciation of life itself is what he wants to. Now, here, this place, this moment, what you do, how you act, whom you hurt or help or don't hurt or don't help, yourself, of myself I sing. Yeah. He embraces the world, you see.
Oh, that's great.
Is it sane to still cherish that Whitman vision as the real thing, even as Studs Terkel did?
It's marvelously sane. One could say that, in fact, it's probably our only hope.
Amen.
Finally. And maybe it's the only hope for the world to have that kind of acute sensitivity to others, to others in a more encompassing way than religion does. I think that's really one of the most interesting things about him. And he says that he really wants to encompass religious visions because religious visions quickly become excluding, they quickly choose people to be the chosen people. Whether they're ancient Jews or modern Christians, I am the chosen among the chosen and you are not. And that for him was the original sin of human beings. And I certainly agree with that.
C.K. Williams, is a wonderful poem late in your new book called The Foundation, which not only cites Whitman but has a certain Whitmanian energy and surge about it. I wonder if you'd read that and make a connection with the great Walt.
The Foundation. Watch me, I'm running. Watch me, I'm dancing, I'm air. The building I used to live in has been razed, and I'm skipping, hopping, two-footedly leaping across the blocks, bricks, slabs of concrete, plaster, and other unnameable junk. Or nameable, really, if you look at the wreckage closely. Here, for instance, this shattered I-beam is the Bible, and this chunk of mortar, Plato, the mortar of mind, also in pieces in me anyway, in my mind. Aristotle and Nietzsche, Freud and Camus and Buber and Christ even, that year of reading Paradise Lost, when I thought, hell, why not, but that fractured too. Kierkegaard, Hegel, and Kant, and Goffman, and Marx, all heaped in the foundation, and I've sped through so often that now I have it by heart, can run, dance, be air, not think of the spew of intellectual dust I scuffed up when in my barely broken-in boots I first clumped through the sanctums of Buddhism, Taoism, Zen, and the Areopagite even, whose entire text I typed out, my God, why? I didn't care. I just kept bumping my head on the lintels, Einstein, the Gnostics, Kabbalah, Saint this and Saint that. Watch me again now, because I'm not alone in my dancing, my being air. I'm with my poets, my Rilke, my Yeats. We're leaping together through the debris, a jumble of wrack, but my Keats floats across it, my Herbert and Dunn, my Cannell, my Bishop and Blake are soaring across it, my Frost, Baudelaire, my Dickinson, Lowell and Larkin, and my giants, my Whitman, my Shakespeare, my Dante and Homer. They were the steel. Though scouring as I was the savants and sages, half the time I hardly knew it. But Vallejo was there all along, and my Sidney and Shelley, my Coleridge and Hopkins there all along with their music, which is why I can whirl through the rubble of everything else, the philosophizing and theories, the thesis and ante and sin. All I believe must be what meanings were made of, when really it was the singing, the choiring, the cadence, the lull of the vowels, the chromatical consonant clatter. Watch me again. I haven't landed. I'm hovering here over the fragments, the remnants, the splinters and shards. My poets are with me, my soarers, my skimmers, my skaters, aloft on their song in the ruins, their jubilant song of the ruins.
There's Whitman among your giants, Shakespeare, yes. Dante, and Homer. Yes. Maybe that says it all.
Well, he's certainly among the giants. I've really come to believe that. I mean, in a way, I hadn't before I began to really, really go more deeply into him and to write this book, that he is one of the greatest poets who ever lived, one of the handful of greatest poets who ever lived. And in a way, he's so close to us that one feels a little squeamish saying that. You know, you like... Maybe next year we'll discover that, in fact, he wasn't that great. But I don't believe that. I really do think he is on that scale of those giants.
You say it very persuasively and very, very well. It's a joy to hear you celebrate the man and the poet. And also, I must say, to say that his vision still makes profound sense for this country.
Oh, I agree completely. Completely. Thank you. It's been very nice to speak to you.
Great pleasure to hear you. C.K. Williams, thank you. Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.